Hi, Dave Emery here, side two of For the Record program number 791. They may not know art, but they know what they like. This is being recorded on May 4th of the year 2014. We're going to plunge right back in where we left off. We have been dealing with a working hypothesis presented by Simon Dunstan and Gerard Williams in their book Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. Originally, they began their investigation as looking into what they considered a conspiracy theory, and after investigating it, they became obviously mostly convinced, more or less convinced, more than less convinced that the theory was in fact accurate. It involved the escape of Adolf Hitler, but more importantly, it involved maneuvering by very powerful institutions and individuals, and Aktion Feuerland, Operation Fireland, named for Tierra del Fuego, involved on the Allied side Alan Dulles as the principal figure, on the Axis side Martin Bormann, and it involved a quid pro quo in which Hitler and other top Nazis would be permitted to escape, and along with them much of the looted wealth of Europe, and in turn the Allies would get many of the top Nazi weapons technologies and the top Nazi scientists, such as SS officer Werner von Braun and the other V2 rocket experts from Peenemünde. And they would also be able to recover the essence or basically the most prized artworks of Europe, which had been looted by the Nazis. Bormann was prepared to have those blown up, and in turn, in exchange for permitting basically the Reich to continue underground, including the escape of Hitler, those artworks were spared. We're going to go into that, a very curious case that that came to light in late 2013 in a minute. But again, note that, as I mentioned in side one, the escape of Hitler personally was something of a peripheral element used by Bormann primarily to cement his own control over the Nazi Party structure during the war and also after the war, and that by the early 50s, Hitler was an isolated figure with no political influence and something of an inconvenience. And according to the author's research, he died in poor mental and physical health in February of 1962. What's really important here are the institutions, and the authors make it very clear that their working hypothesis and the deal to permit Hitler's escape that they posit was inextricably linked with international power politics and the politics of the gathering Cold War in particular. And even though the Nazis were well behind the Allies in terms of the U.S., in terms of developing the atomic bomb, they did have considerable atomic expertise. And just as importantly, the so-called Uranium Club, the club of Nazi atomic bomb scientists, had a nice stash of uranium ore, and part of the deal was making sure that that fell into American and Allied hands instead of into the hands of the Russians. So again, early Cold War politics growing directly out of the closing days of the World War II are central to this. Again, Alan Dulles on the Allied side, Martin Bormann on the Axis side. Jumping back in where we left off, one of the key Nazi agents involved with the Bormann flight capital, which in turn helped to prepare the groundwork for Aktion Feuerland, was none other than Eva Duarte, D-U-A-R-T-E, later and better known as Eva Peron or Evita. She was a Nazi spy and a Bormann agent, according to the research developed here by the authors. Recouping something that we looked at the end of side one for continuity purposes, Ludwig Freuder's and Eva Duarte's involvement in the smuggling operation was made clear in an Argentine police document of April 18th, 1945. This detailed the operations of Freuder, quote, an agent of the Third Reich, unquote, and his dealings with an Argentine agent codenamed Natalio, N-A-T-A-L-I-O. This informant reported that Freuder had made very substantial deposits in various Buenos Aires banks in the name of the well-known radio theatrical actress Maria Eva Duarte. Freuder told Natalio that on February 7th, 1945, a U-boat had brought huge funds to help in the reconstruction of the Nazi Empire. Subsequent police investigations revealed that cases from the U-boat with the words Geheime Reichssache, or Reich Top Secret, unquote, stenciled on them, had been taken to a Lahusen ranch run by two, quote, Nazi brothers just outside Buenos Aires. Deposits of gold and various currencies were later made in Eva Duarte's name at the Banco Alemán, Transatlantico, the Banco Germánico, and the Banco Tornquist, Tornquist. And the authors also hypothesize that the Vatican was deeply involved with the Evita slash Bormann operations, and that the Perones and their Argentine banking associates doubled on Bormann and Heinrich Müller with what ultimately was for the betrayers lethal results. Returning to Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler by Simon Dunstan and Gerard Williams. The all-conquering Evita left Spain for Rome on June 25, 1947. Father Benitez would smooth her way in the Vatican with the aid of Bishop Arois Hudal, H-U-D-A-L, by the way. He was a key member of the Vatican Nazi rat line that helped top Nazi war criminals escape from Europe, courtesy of the Vatican. 2 days after Evita arrived, she was given an audience with Pope Pius XII, spending 20 minutes with the Holy Father, quote, a time usually allotted by Vatican protocol to queens only, unquote. However, there was a more sinister side to the Rome trip. Using Bishop Hudal as an intermediary, she arranged to meet with Martin Bormann in an Italian villa at Rapallo, provided for her use by Argentine shipping billionaire Alberto Dodero, D-O-D-E-R-O. The ship owner was also present at the meeting, as was Eva's brother, Juan Duarte. There, she and her former paymaster cut the deal that guaranteed that his Führer's safe haven would continue to remain safe, and allowed Bormann to leave Europe at last for a new life in South America. However, Evita and her team had one shocking disappointment for Bormann. Skipping down. Proving that there is no honor among thieves, the Perones presented Bormann with a radical renegotiation of their earlier understanding. Evita had brought with her to Europe some $800 million worth of the treasure that he had placed in supposed safekeeping in Argentina, and she would deposit this vast sum in Swiss banks for the Perones' own personal use. Skipping down again. However, the Bormann organization had a keen memory. After the spring of 1948, when Müller himself, that's Heinrich Müller, former Gestapo chief and security director for the Bormann Group, when Müller based himself in Cordoba and became directly responsible for the security of the organization, the bankers who had betrayed Bormann would begin to suffer a string of untimely deaths. Heinrich Dorge, D-O-E-R-G-E, died mysteriously in 1949. In December of 1950, Ricardo von Leute was found dead in the Buenos Aires street, and Ricardo Stout would survive him by only a few months. Ludwig Freude himself, the kingpin of Oxenfeuerland in Argentina, died in 1952 from drinking a poisoned cup of coffee, and Evita's younger brother Juan Duarte met his end in 1954 with a gunshot to the head. Officially, he was said to have committed suicide. I would also note, although it's not mentioned here, it's mentioned that she died in 1952. Evita herself died of a fast-acting case of cancer at the ripe old age of 33. As we've seen in numerous programs, cancer can be used as a weapon of assassination. And Evita was basically the key element of Juan Perón's public persona. She was an actress, and it was not really from humble origins at all, but that was portrayed as part of her persona, and she was the ostensible champion of the shirtless ones, the Argentine poor. Once she died, Juan Perón was revealed as basically the prophylactic that he basically was. When it came to light, for example, that he was having an affair with a 13-year-old girl, he deflected public criticism with the witticism that, quote, "What's the problem? I'm not superstitious," unquote. And that didn't go over real well in Catholic Argentina in the early 1950s. He was overthrown not too long after that. Now, jumping from the past to the present, in late 2013, the last couple of months of 2013, some stories emerged about a very strange discovery of a huge cache of looted Nazi art in Munich, Germany. Now, bear in mind that the key element of the Faustian deal that authors Simon Dunstan and Gerard Williams hypothesized took place between Alan Dulles and Martin Bormann was the agreement by the Nazis not to destroy the creme de la creme of Western art, but the key elements of 1,000 years of Western art history. There are substantive indications that that art subsequently became part of the post-war German capital maneuvering, and we're going to examine the case of Cornelius Gurlitt, G-U-R-L-I-T-T, and his father Hildebrand Gurlitt in the context of the Nazi maneuvering around the art and the working hypothesis that is presented by Dunstan and Gerard in their book Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. New York Times of November 5th, 2013, about 5 months ago. Report of Nazi looted trove puts art world in an uproar. It's by Allison Smale, and it reads in part, if confirmed, and by the way it was, the discovery would be one of the biggest finds of vanished art in years. But word of it left almost equally big questions unanswered. Why did the German authorities let nearly 2 years pass before such a sizable find was disclosed? What will become of the recovered works of art? Did Mr. Cornelius Gurlitt continue to make sales even after the raid? And where is he today? Yet he, as his father Hildebrand Gurlitt, was also one of the few Germans granted permission by Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda chief, to sell confiscated art. Sales to foreign buyers were meant to fill Nazi coffers, but art historians have documented many sales in Germany, as well as proceeds pocketed by the dealers involved. And there are a number of very interesting connections, interesting aspects to this. Bear in mind that in Germany, every citizen has to register with the police. If you, say, live in Hanover and you're going to move to Berlin, when you move, you have to deregister yourself with the Hanover police and in turn register your presence with the Berlin police. So people turning up undocumented and their whereabouts simply doesn't take place. The Germans are very thorough and intense and far-sighted people. They're not like Sergeant Schultz in Hogan's Heroes. They don't, they're not a bunch of Keystone cops. So these contradictions, these apparent holes in the investigation are to be seen in an intelligent light against the thoroughness and farsightedness and the rigorousness of the German people and their authorities. Another article about this. This from November 18th of 2013. For son of a Nazi-era dealer, a private life amid a tainted trove of artists by Andrew Higgins and Katrin Benhold, B-E-N-N-H-O-L-D, again from the New York Times, of November 18th of 2013. It reads in part, despite his seclusion, Mr. Cornelius Gurlitt clearly calculated his risks. When German customs officers questioned him in 2010 on a train to Munich from Switzerland, where he is known to have a bank account and has sold at least one work, they discovered he was carrying nearly 9,000 euros, just below the legal limit. His excessively shy manner nonetheless set off alarm bells. Their volume increased when investigators discovered later that Mr. Gurlitt did not exist, bureaucratically speaking. He was not listed in Munich's Registry of Residents or in any other official records, parenthetically. That doesn't happen. That is really, really suspicious. Continuing. Watching over his family's art trove was Mr. Gurlitt's only known job. Periodically, he dipped into the collection to select the work to sell, a need that, according to Der Spiegel, became more pressing in recent years as his health declined. The last piece he is known to have sold, The Lion Tamer, by the German artist Max Beckmann, fetched €864,000, or $1.17 million, including commissions, at an auction in Cologne in 2011. Mr. Gurlitt agreed to give 45% of the proceeds to a Jewish family that had originally owned the work. Shortly after he, Hildebrand, the elder Gurlitt, was detained there and questioned. By the way, this concerns the detention of Hildebrand Gurlitt by Allied authorities, and by the way, figuring prominently in this part of the story are these so-called monuments men. Those were art experts that were put together by the Allies to locate the looted works of art. They figure prominently in the working hypothesis presented in Grey Wolf. They helped to locate the art that was spared as part of the Faustian deal between Dulles and Martin Bormann, according to the author's hypothesis. Again, they began investigating what they considered to be a conspiracy theory and wound up basically convinced of its validity. Soon after he, Hildebrand, the elder Gurlitt, was detained there and questioned by the group of historians, curators, and soldiers entrusted with safeguarding Europe's cultural heritage. In his statements to investigators, Hildebrand emphasized his anti-Nazi sentiments and maintained that he had never handled stolen art and that the works in his possession were mostly the personal property of my family or myself, unquote. Investigators concluded that he was not an important player in the art trade and later returned to him more than 115 paintings in addition to drawings and other fine art objects. Parenthetically, this smacks of some sort of deal as well. Hildebrand Gurlitt was not an unimportant player at all, and returning 115 valuable paintings. Again, his son sold one painting for $1.17 million. This basically smacks of a cover-up and part of the post-World War II Allied-Nazi agreements that took place, including the capital maneuverings of the Bormann Network. Continuing with this New York Times article of 11/18/2013. In 1956, Hildebrand Gurlitt died in a crash on the Autobahn while racing from Berlin back to the family's home in Dusseldorf. In late 1966, a government agency in Berlin responsible for the restitution of assets plundered during the Nazi era sent a formal letter asking about four paintings acquired by her husband. Mrs. Gurlitt replied that all her husband's records and artworks had been incinerated, unquote, when the Allies bombed Dresden in February of 1945. The search of Cornelius's apartment last year proved this to be a deception. Investigators found not only paintings, but also record books kept by his father. And one of the things that is complicating the possibility of returning some of the Nazi looted art to the owners is a law that is on the books in Germany that was set up during the closing days of the Reich. This again from the New York Times of November 20th of 2013, article by Melissa Eddy, EDDY, and Allison Smale, SMALE. Enduring Nazi law impedes recovery of art, reads in part. Wolfgang Bucke was amazed this month when a watercolor seized by the Nazis from the small museum in this eastern city, where he is the curator, reappeared, part of a vast trove uncovered in a Munich apartment. But his excitement at seeing the work, landscape with horses, a possible study for a 1911 painting by the German expressionist Franz Marc, was tempered by one fact he called irrefutable, unquote. The 1938 law that allowed the Nazis to seize it in the first place and thousands of other modernist artworks deemed degenerate, unquote, because Hitler viewed them as un-German or Jewish in nature, remains on the books to this day. Parenthetically, one of the things that Cornelius and his father Hildebrand Gurlitt did, particularly Hildebrand, was to traffic in this degenerate art on behalf of Joseph Goebbels. Basically, although it was deemed to be, quote, Jewish and degenerate, it was known to be valuable abroad, and so it was sold abroad to garner badly needed hard foreign currency. Continuing with this New York Times story from 11/20/13. The German authorities say they believe that 380 works confiscated from German public museums under the Nazi-era law may be among the more than 1,200 paintings, lithographs, and drawings found stashed away in the apartment of Cornelius Gurlitt, the reclusive 80-year-old son of a Nazi-era art dealer. The law's existence renders slim the likelihood that Mr. Bucke's museum or dozens of others in Germany can ever reclaim their works, German legal experts and museum and government officials say. And that law is likely to remain in place. And of Cornelius Gerlet, a very good article in Der Spiegel of December 23rd, 2013, reads, Art Dealer to the Fuhrer, Hildebrand Gerlet's Deep Nazi Ties. It's by Felix Bohr, Lothar Goris, Ulrika Nofel, Sven Robel, and Michael Sondheimer. And it makes a number of points here. Again, it notes that Hildebrand Gerlet was an art dealer to the Fuhrer, and it has some very, very interesting aspects here, skipping down in the story. Gerlet, they wrote, was an art collector from Hamburg with connections with high-level Nazi circles. He acted on behalf of other Nazi officials and made many trips to France from where he brought home art collections. There is reason to believe that these private art collections consisted of looted art from other countries. For the monument's men, Gerlet was also an art dealer to the Fuhrer himself, unquote. Skipping down again, talking about the recent film The Monument's Men, starring George Clooney. It would be a film about the country's elites who benefited from the crimes of the Nazis, a story about culprits who quickly transformed themselves into supposedly upstanding citizens, and in the new Germany became the pillars of society once again. Skipping down. It was during those days that Gerlet, the art dealer to the Fuhrer, reinvented himself as a victim of the Nazis, a man who had saved precious artworks from destruction, and someone who had never done anything malicious, unquote. Skipping down again. And talking about the fact that Hildebrand Gerlet was one of the people recruiting art for the Fuhrer Museum in Linz, Austria. Linz was to be the site of Hitler's massive Fuhrer Museum. It was never built, and yet the Nazis bought enough art to fill three museums. Hermann Voss, V-O-S-S, a museum director from Wiesbaden who had also run a museum in Dresden, ran the art-buying program from 1943 onward. From then on, Gerlet worked for Hitler through Voss, who served as a middleman. He also bought art for German museums that had been brought into line by the regime, as well as for private citizens like Hamburg cigarette manufacturer Hermann F. Reimsma, R-W-M-T-S-M-A, Hanover chocolate magnate Bernhard Sprengel, and Cologne lawyer Josef Halbricht. And skipping down still once more about Gerlet. Art historian Michael Bruns discovered that Hamburg industrialist Hermann F. Reimsma, who, by the way, was very close to the SS, was one of Gerlet's regular customers and had bought two of the drawings. After the war, the Wolfson family's attorney demanded the return of the drawings, but Gerlet refused to provide any information about the buyers. In 1993, two of the works in the Wolfson collection were included in the memorial exhibition titled Works of Art That Affect Me, the collector Hermann F. Reimsma. And skipping down again, Müller Hofstetter ordered paintings picked up from Jewish homes and, using an obsequious tone, wrote to Gerlet to offer him the works. He also mentioned that he was even willing to come to Dresden to present the pictures to Gerlet. His letter ended with the words, Heil Hitler. And again, Hildebrand Gerlet, the fellow who put together this collection of Nazi art, was one of the people who was garnering art for the Fuhrer Museum. And some of those artworks, their whereabouts remains a mystery. Again, from the Der Spiegel article, there are many examples of works that Gerlet acquired under questionable circumstances. There are also a number of pictures hanging in German museums today, from Hanover to Wiesbaden, that were bought from Gerlet. There are even pictures that Hildebrand Gerlet, bought for Hitler's museum in Linz, which, because of their unclear origins, became the property of the German state. One such painting, a landscape by the classicist painter Jakob Philipp Hackert, hangs in the German Foreign Ministry today. And about the formation of the generation of art collecting for the Fuhrer Museum, returning again to Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. In the months following the annexation of Austria in 1938, Hitler decided to create the greatest art museum in the world in the city of Linz, close to his birthplace. The Führer Museum was planned to become the repository of all the great works of art Luther during the Nazi Wars of Conquest, except, of course, for those pieces devoted to the private collections of Adolf Hitler, Hermann Goering, and a few select others of the Nazi elite. And this was what Hildebrand Gurlitt was working for, and he was recruiting directly for the Führer Museum, and his son inherited that collection. And again, the mysteries surrounding that are very, very interesting indeed. Some of the contradictions in that. Again, why did the German, from the first of the articles we read, November 5th of New York, of 2013, all of these are New York Times stories, why did the German authorities let nearly 2 years pass before a sizable fine was disclosed? What will become of the recovered works of art? Did Mr. Cornelius Gurlitt continue to make sales even after the raid? And where is he today? Again, the fact they couldn't figure out where he was is strange. And of his father, Hildebrand Gurlitt was one of the few Germans granted permission by Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda chief, to sell confiscated art. Sales to foreign buyers were meant to fill Nazi coffers, but art historians have documented many sales in Germany, as well as proceeds pocketed by the dealers involved. And again, the circumstances surrounding Cornelius are strange. Despite his seclusion, Mr. Gurlitt clearly calculated his risks. When German customs officers questioned him in 2010 on a train to Munich from Switzerland, where he is known to have a bank account and has sold at least one work, they discovered he was carrying 9,000 euros, just below the legal limit. His excessively shy manner nonetheless set off alarm bells. Their volume increased when investigators discovered later that Mr. Gurlitt did not exist, bureaucratically speaking. He was not listed in Munich's registry of residence or in other records. Supposedly he was selling this to finance his health problems, or to cover his health problems. Watching over his family art probe was Mr. Gurlitt's only known job. Periodically, he dipped into the collection to select the work to sell, a need that, according to Der Spiegel, became more pressing in recent years as his health declined. The last piece he is known to have sold, The Lion Tamer, unquote, by the German artist Max Beckmann, fetched 864,000 euros, or $1.17 million. And again, why did the Monuments Men let him go? I also wonder about Cornelius Gurlitt's, why did the Monuments Men let the elder Hildebrand Gurlitt go? I also wonder, again, this guy was making a lot of money, and yet didn't exist bureaucratically. One painting he sold for $1.17 million. That's a lot of aspirin, supposedly to cover his health care. Why did the Monuments Men let him go? This guy was an art dealer to Hitler personally. I also find the circumstances of Hildebrand's death. In 1956, Hildebrand Gurlitt died in a crash on the Autobahn while racing from Berlin back to the family's home in Dusseldorf. I wonder about the circumstances of that crash. Berlin, during the Cold War, was well inside of what was then East Germany, although it was divided between East and West Berlin. It was a hotbed of Cold War espionage and intrigue in this time period. I wonder what Mr. Gurlitt was doing in Berlin, why he was, quote, racing back, unquote, to Dusseldorf when he was killed in an auto accident. Again, the recent uncovery and very mysterious circumstances and contradictions in connection with this huge trove of looted Nazi art worth many millions of dollars suggests intrigue, and I have been examining this against the background of the book Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, which posits that the transfer of Western art treasures was part of Oxenfeuerland's deal between Dulles and Bormann. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program 791. They may not know art, but they know what they like. Being recorded on May 4th of 2014, I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.